every third bite of food you take, thank a bee or a pollinator. Fact. Without bees to spread seeds, many plants, including food crops, would die off. Cross-pollination helps at least 30% of the world's crops, 90% of the wild plants to thrive, and something like $15 billion a year plus in U.S. crops are pollinated by bees. So clearly, recognizing, supporting, understanding what's going on and what's going wrong is in everybody's best interest. So today we've got four experts we're going to engage in the conversation. And because Jay Leno is now unemployed and Jimmy Fallon's contract is a little uncertain, we're going to do this one a little bit differently because, you know, why not be a talk show host in that? So we're going to bring people up one at a time and ask them to sort of slide down as we have the conversation. So first, it's my pleasure to introduce you to Lori Adams. She's executive director of the Pollinator Partnership and its signature initiatives, the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign and the National Pollinator Week. In this position, she's appeared on all kinds of media and shows, not to mention, well, she's not done Jimmy Fallon yet, but you're about to do that. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lori Adams. Lori, why don't you sit here, and we'll chat a bit, and then just like on the Tonight Show, she'll move down a seat, and we'll have the next guest up. And so first of all, tell us a little bit about your operation and what you and what you're doing and what you've been looking at.
Well, I'm the executive director of the Pollinator Partnership, which is a nonprofit. We work all over North America. We're the largest organization in the world that deals exclusively with pollinator issues. And pollinators aren't just bees and they aren't just honeybees. They're also flies, do a fair amount of crop pollination as well, and there are a number of bees that do crop pollination, but it's also butterflies, bats, beetles, all kinds of animals that help with the reproduction of plants, both in ecosystems and in crop systems.
You've recently been involved in a remarkable research project, and there's some elements of that that are really quite unusual. Stress that?
Well, there are a lot of issues that are stressing pollinators right now. There are multiple factors that are causing real problems in the pollinating community.
Bees first.
Bees, because we pay a lot of attention to bees, but probably other species as well. We don't have the funds to monitor the health of other species. Honeybees are the system that we look at most.
And that's the one we're hearing about most.
And that's what we're hearing about. The things that are stressing them are climate change. Huge. I watched the news this morning, and I looked at the East Coast and the Midwest, and I thought, these extremes aren't just harming humans. This is, most insects tell time by temperature. They rely on plants to emerge at the right time. So the stressors of climate change are huge in the pollinating community. So climate change, forage, lack of places to get food when there are diminishing habitat, that's a huge issue. Parasites, pathogens, all the diseases that they're subjected to, but also pesticides are a huge issue, as well as management if it's a managed pollinator system. So yes, we had a project that I am so excited to be able to tell to the ag media community. It's a privilege to talk about this project because I think there are two really important things about it. One, the process that we use to investigate a very small portion of the neonicotinoid process and problem with bees and crops interfacing. Very small, very discrete section. The process we used to get to a very small answer, but the process we used and the recommendations that we'd like to put forth. So here's the situation. In corn production, when you plant, during the planting, you have large pneumatic planters that use very sophisticated techniques to get seeds planted. And those processes have to be lubricated so the seeds don't stick together.
Right.
Conventional lubricants are really we use talc and graphite are the conventional lubricants. But about 3 years ago, a scientist at Purdue University found out that lubricant itself was adding to the problem. During the abrasion, there was a contamination of that particular lubricant, and it was exhausted through the manifold, and it became dust, fugitive dust. And it was highly contaminated. It went on to blooming plants. It went on to standing water. It was a problem. When that problem happened, Bayer stepped forward and said, maybe we can improve that process. They wanted to test that process, and they went to a number of universities, and people weren't all that interested in having Bayer-sponsored research. Bayer went to EPA, and they went to USDA, and we have a very good science-based relationship with all the agencies and with all the commodity groups.
Yeah.
And they said, why don't you take this project to the Pollinator Partnership and have them be the broker to send out this lubricant for testing to see if we can reduce the dust in corn dust, the corn dust issue. They came to us and with Syngenta, so it was unique already. It was two competitors coming to us and saying, help us test
this. You'd be the honest broker in there.
You'd be the honest broker. We said, well, that's an interesting process. We'd like to do that, but we don't want just your voices involved. We want the National Corn Growers Association. We want the American Seed Trade Association. We want the American Manufacturers Association. We want the Farm Equipment Manufacturers Association. We want the American Beekeeping Federation. We want the American Honey Producers Association. We want the Canadian Honey Council.
Why did you want everybody involved?
Because in order for this to be fully transparent and for us to have all the voices together, and this is how we like to work. We like to work collaboratively. We wanted everybody to see how are we picking these universities, how are we selecting the protocol, how are we reviewing the data, and how are we coming up with recommendations.
Because you didn't want the findings or anything that came out of this to be seen to be
suspect.
Bought and paid for. By, right.
Mm-hmm. Suspect. And I think
so did you get everybody on board?
We got everybody on board, and everybody said, fine, we'll share this responsibility. We'll spend a year. Let's see if we can do this within a year so that before the 2014 planting season, we have something
that
can improve it. Well, first of all, we thought we were just going to do one set of research. We did the lubricant, but we also took a good look at what's happening in cornfields during this time. What are the floral resources that might be there that would influence honeybees? And we confined this to just corn and just honeybees. So there are other factors, but we tried to keep focused. So we sent out an RFP, and we awarded grants to Iowa State, Ohio State, and the University of Guelph. So we were doing this not just at three institutions, but in two countries. We talked with the researchers. They each designed their own projects, so we didn't enforce anything on them in terms of synchronicity. We said, do it the way you want to understand this issue. We connected them to one another so they could cross-reference. And then we monitored it during the year, and we now have a report which is available on www.pollinator.org. So it's called the CDRC, the Corn Dust Research Consortium, and it will tell you what we did, what we found, and how we think, at least with 1 year's data, we can help the situation.
What's the main takeaway?
Well, the two main takeaways. It's a great story that in a very, very antagonistic situation, we were able to get people to work together. And I think solving environmental, agricultural problems, we got to get together. We've got to stop fighting. So that's one takeaway. You can do it. The second takeaway is we came out with recommendations not just for corn farmers, but also for beekeepers and also for the media. We have recommendations for regulators, for equipment manufacturers, for pesticide manufacturers. We found that there's something that everybody has some skin in this game. So there are a lot of recommendations. They're all provisional. They're a first step. But this is a place that I would hope you who are telling the story of agriculture will look at this, look at the recommendations. There are lots of them, so I can't really go through them all.
Laura, give them the lead out of this. What did you learn about what's killing these bees? What did you learn about how to change the rate of decline or the rate of deaths? What's the bottom line here?
Well, I'd say the first thing is the lubricant was successful in reducing the active ingredient, the AI, by about 28%. That's a different percentage than what Bayer found.
But what does that mean? What does that mean about what's killing the bees and what will stop killing the bees?
When you're planting corn, you have to pay attention to a whole lot of mechanics, one of which is drift. So drift is a concept that something unintended moves from where you want it to be.
Drift of pesticide?
Drift. Yeah, drift. So these fugitive dusts have the potential to drift. What we found is you can reduce that by about 28% by using BFA, which is called the Bayer Fluency Agent. But that's not the silver bullet. I think I know you want me to tell a simple answer. It's a complex question. It's going to have a complex answer. So using the fluency agent, that helps. Paying attention to any of the elements of drift, wind, humidity, these are things that farmers need to pay attention to. Beekeepers also need to pay attention to where they're putting their bees and how they communicate with farmers.
Okay.
There's a lot to say.
And we'll say more. I want to bring up our next participant in the conversation, Dr. Troy Anderson. Dr. Anderson is Assistant Professor of Insect Toxicology and Pharmacology, the Department of Entomology and Fralin Life Science Institute, Professor of Neuroscience and Health Science at Virginia Tech. That is a lot to put on a business card. Dr. Anderson's research and teaching focuses on the identification of insecticide modes of action and management insecticide resistance, target site discovery, design of insecticides. Principal investigator of a five-year project to investigate pesticide exposures to and health status of honeybee colonies in Virginia. What are you finding?
So we just started this study with in the last year, and so we just completed a survey over six different agricultural areas of Virginia. And what we are doing is we're collecting bees from local beekeepers. We're collecting wax, pollen from these bee colonies. And then we're doing a multi-residue or multi-pesticide residue analysis to find, you know, what are some of the candidate compounds that are in these hives.
So a multi-residue residue.
Multi, yeah, pesticides.
Oh, pesticides, yeah. Right. So you're looking at what? You're actually taking the bees and looking at what's there.
And the wax and the pollen, yes.
Okay, and what are you finding?
Well, so what we've limited it to are herbicides, insecticides, and some fungicides. And so it's kind of a, with the first year, our sample size isn't big enough to really come to any conclusions of what's there, but we do have a variety of different pesticides that are within these hives. And the purpose is to basically take to the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, you know, those different chemistries that are there, the levels of those chemistries, and can they use that with their bee health inspection team, and also with any type of regulatory issues associated with that. Mm-hmm. But we're also looking at other factors on bee health. We're looking at nutrition. We're looking at immunity, also pathogen levels within those hives, too.
And you've also been involved in the Varroa Mite Summit, so tell us about that.
Yes, yeah, so we just wrapped up the Varroa Mite Summit up in Washington, D.C. last week. It was a two-day event where we had several experts across the world come in and give their opinion on what needs to happen with the management of varroa mite. And so we defined some priority areas. One is to better understand the basic biology of varroa mites. Another one is to provide some resistance management and monitoring efforts to understand or to be able to possibly select for more of a mite-tolerant honeybee, and then also look at other nutritional and immune factors that are affected by varroa mites. And so several different priorities there, one of those being, you know, the development of new varroacides to manage mites, but also characterizing resistance levels. And I think then also we identified a variety of different challenges, too, and those end up being, you know, funding efforts for this, and then alongside that is basically alignment of research areas, you know, and then getting stakeholder investment
into. Sure. So if somebody comes up to you at a cocktail party and says, you know, you're doing all this great research and you've been to Washington, you've been to the Mite Summit, that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad summit to go to, I guess.
Right.
What's killing the bees?
What's killing the bees?
What do you say to them?
How much time do we have?
Hey, it depends on how good the cocktail party is,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly. As Lori said, there are multiple stressors. It's not any one, and they're interacting with each other. I mean, you have pest infestations, you have parasite infections, you have nutritional problems, immune problems, management issues, landscape alterations, forage issues.
Some of these things have been around for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. Right? None of this is new.
Right. So what are you learning? I guess that's the question. What are you, in this research, what are you seeing? Are you getting new data that are shedding new light on this problem?
Not necessarily. I mean, what we're finding, so the focus of my research program is pesticide exposures and bee health. And what we focus mainly on are these varroacides to control varroa mite. And we're not seeing huge differences in health effects with these varroacides. We know that they're not as efficacious as they used to be, and their resistance has been developing with these varroacides. But for the most part, until we finish our first survey with these health issues in Virginia, it's hard to pinpoint if what factors are contributing to that. So with collecting this data, what we want, basically want to be able to do is to develop a health model so that we can pick out, you know, a couple of those factors that we can assist beekeepers with managing.
What do you want to get to at the end of this research, this five-year research project?
I would like to be able to define what a healthy bee is, because at this point I can't do that.
What do you mean you can't define what a healthy bee is?
I don't think there is such a thing as a healthy bee from what I've learned.
Really?
I got involved in this about 3 years ago, and being able to work with, you know, a wonderful individual at Virginia Tech, Professor Rick Fell, who is our resident apiculturist. And, you know, going out and looking at a bee colony, it's such a complex machine that's working about there, and that you not only have a livestock, but you have a crop. And then finding out, you know, asking that question to him, what is a healthy bee? And then he starts naming off all of these different stressors. And these can be, you know, apparent at any one time and all together. So how do you single out? And I don't think we have baseline data to be able to identify what that healthy bee is.
So this is a continuing mystery.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, you're going to solve all the problems in the next 4 years.
I wish.
All right, let me call up our third panelist. Before I do that, we'd hope to have a fourth panelist contributing to the conversation today, fourth generation North Dakota beekeeper, Zach Browning of Browning's Honey Company. Unfortunately, he's unable to join us today because his mostly migratory commercial operation, which runs 22,000 hives in three different states, and they truck and rent bees to all these different farms. They're actually doing that, and he's actually got to be working for a living, so he's not able to be with us here today. But I would like to introduce National Cotton Council's integrated pest management expert, Dr. Don Parker. And if you guys could just slide down one more, we'll continue the musical chairs. Don's a manager of integrated pest management for the National Cotton Council of America. He's based in Memphis, Tennessee. His role, you address the technical and regulatory issues related to cotton pests and serve as assistant to the executive director of the Cotton Foundation, and you're a Mississippi State University graduate. Previously served as assistant professor, research extension, entomology and facilities, coordinator of the Brown Loam Branch Experiment Station at MSU. So thanks.
Thank you.
What's your stake in the bee discussion?
Well, the National Cotton Council has been very involved in this for about 5 years. We've been monitoring some developments as they were taking place. And naturally, our initial concern is that we understand we have pests in the field that destroy crops, and we have to have the ability to control those pests. Now, when a lot of the focus that has come out with this, the bee health decline, and you know, initially they called it colony collapse disorder, and then they found out it's bigger than just that, and they've gone to this bee health decline. A lot of the focus has been on pesticides, although the science and ARS and all of the different ones point out there's multiple factors that are involved here. There are several groups that have concentrated their efforts to focus on pesticides and what can they do to restrict or, in some cases, cancel some of the pesticides. And there's lawsuits filed against EPA and different things like that. And that's of concern to us because there are some of these products that are critical for our industry. And we really don't have acceptable substitutes for them at this time. So we have been very engaged trying to make sure that that the science is actually what is leading this discussion and all, and not just personal agendas or politics. And you know, I have to compliment EPA at this point that they have actually stood with the science so far, and we encourage them to continue that. They have received a lot of political pressure trying to move towards cancellation of the neonics, as did the European Union. And so far, we've been able to stick with the science to say that there is no smoking gun that shows pesticides are the cause of this phenomenon.
But what is your what is your posture towards the kind of research that's going on that is finding all these pesticides? And what are, as an organization, what are you prepared to say or do as these results come out? Or is your position a rigid position?
No, our position is rigid in that we want to know what the science is. What does the science show? And not just a study that does a lab study with a dose that's 10 times what would ever be used in the field. We want to know field-relevant science as to what is going on. Now, we actually, whenever this all started out, we met with the beekeepers, both associations, and we said, look, we want to work with you on this. We understand the dilemma. And if you put yourself in a beekeeper's position, and for several years now you have had overwintering losses that, you know, nationally, I think last year the average was around 32%. That meant some were receiving 70% loss of colonies during the winter. They are in a very tough dilemma, and they are really trying to find an immediate answer. The science can't identify an immediate answer right now. There is a lot of the things, though, that what we realized is that we don't. There's a lot of lack of information, a lack of understanding. For instance, in cotton, cotton does not require bees or other insects to pollinate it. Cotton is a self-pollinating crop. Soybeans does not require the bees to pollinate them. Corn does not require the bees to pollinate them. And so then our question started around, okay, so are bees actually coming to cotton? And when I first started visiting with some of the researchers, they said, well, bees really don't like cotton. And I said, well, where's the data? I need the data. So we found out there were big gaps of data that we didn't have. And then there were some groups that were making assumptions saying, well, if there's a flower present, there's bees present, and cotton has extra floral nectar, so the nectar has got to be contaminated. We funded a big research project along with corn and soybean, and parts of that was talked about at this past year's Beltwide. But it actually showed that in the cotton system, that some of these products that they had claimed would be in nectar, they were not in nectar. They went out and tested fields and had a huge data set.
What have you learned then about bees and cotton?
We have learned that as far as pollen is concerned, bees really don't, that's not an issue for us because
presence.
Bees don't collect the pollen
right.
of cotton. The not just the presence, but, you know, they collect pollen to feed on. They don't really collect cotton pollen, though, because it has long spines on it. There's a great research paper out that shows these long spines make it where it doesn't pack and they don't utilize it. We're still trying to understand more about when are they in the field, at what times of the year, and can we identify windows that would be our best time to treat. Another thing that I need to point out is that we've also pointed out to EPA and several other groups that there, whenever you start talking about, well, what's the best management practice that could be used here? And we've had the position that this is not a one line that a national organization can lay out that applies across the whole country. There's big variation in regions, big differences in geographical regions as to how these plants and all interact. So we think that local solutions are really best at helping identify those. And we've been involved in some different efforts to try to make producers aware. You know, a lot of us know about the issue. In Washington, D.C., it's coffee shop talk. It's on the news. It's everywhere. But whenever we started going out to the grassroots on the farm and asking our producers, you know, are you aware of this? Or do you know what's going on? They had heard that there was this bee mortality issue, but they did not see how to tie it back to their farm, how it related to their operation.
So there's a big information gap on the farm.
Yes.
Both in terms of information and in terms of relevance to their own operation or to the larger
Absolutely.
Ecosystem.
So then we started a survey, said, okay, what if we were trying to look at some farmers who had been working with a beekeeper for several years and find out what is it that they're doing that works best. And as we started doing this type of survey, we found out in the typical situation would be that a beekeeper drives up to a farmer and he says, hey, I would like to put some bees out there on your property. Do you mind? And the farmer says, I don't care. And he puts them out there. And I asked him, I said, okay, who is the beekeeper? Well, I can't remember his name, but he'll be by here in a couple of months. And so there was no communication beyond, can I have permission to be on your property?
I didn't even know the guy who's leaving the bees behind.
Okay. In some cases, they didn't even know who the guy was that left the bees. So we realized real quick, hey, there is a major advancement we can make right here just in communication, improve some communication aspects. We recently put out a paper to try to, and it's on the National Cotton Council's website, but we released it at Beltwide. We've sent it out to a lot of different organizations. It ties about 10 different events together to help a producer see how does this directly relate to my farm operation, why is it important to me, and to try to encourage this effort for communication between the two.
All right, let me leave that and open it up to conversation. Laura, I saw you nod your head a moment ago. Something struck a nerve.
Yeah, it's about communication. I think access to information about best practices is pretty hard to find. Where do you go? What is the trusted source? And especially, we've been talking about it for the last day in a very impressive way. When you go on the internet, often the loudest voice is the most extreme voice, too. So how do you find real information based on science? USDA and EPA asked us to look at four cropping systems. Melon, which I'd like to talk to the onion man about, but melon, corn, almond, and apple. And we were asked to look and see what is out there, what information is available. If you
What'd you find?
Well, our report's going to be on our website, pollinator.org. We found that in some cropping systems, especially if they're pollinator-dependent, there's a lot. If they're not, it's a little hard to find out what are you supposed to do. And our view is that farmers are excellent stewards of the landscape. They want to do the right thing. It's not in anybody's interest to kill bees. They know that, even if their crop is not dependent on bees. They understand that this is a bigger picture and that the health of the landscape is dependent on their actions. So that's a resource. I've been hearing over the last day how hard it is to get through to youth and to communicate to youth. We have a Bee Smart school garden kit, and it doesn't necessarily teach you how to build a garden. It teaches you how to raise a plant. And again, this is something that used to be standard practice in all schools. You would grow something, and it's missing now. We've supplied that. We have lists for farmers if they want to put in buffer strips, if they want to put in cover crops. On our website, we have lists of plants that are regionally specific. We have an app that does it as well. I mean, communication is a tough thing because you could be communicating with the wrong source. So you have to look at those who are reasonable, who deal with a lot of people.
Let me ask each of you. Actually, I want to ask the audience for a minute, for those of you who are covering and engaging in agriculture journalism. How many of you guys have written or reported on bee and pollinator issues over the last year? A lot of hands. But how many of you come from places where pollinator issues are not significant issues because you're corn or soy or whatever that doesn't require that. So not a few hands. I mean, I'm interested, where This is still a mystery, right? So what are the principal things you feel we still don't know?
Well, it's not so much what we don't know, it's what we've lost.
What do you mean by that?
We've lost habitat. And the number one thing is a clean place for bees and butterflies to forage, to lay their eggs, to get the resources they need to survive. It would happen to any one of us. If we were cut off from nutrition and from our homes, we wouldn't be able to survive.
So that's the purpose of the guy driving up to the cotton farm and saying, can I put my bees here?
Well, you know, I mean, whenever you look back at the pollinator, our managed honeybees, and let's focus just for a second just on managed honeybees. Traditionally, way back, they were basically for production of honey. That business changed over time to where that they became more of a pollination service.
Right.
All of a sudden, you started having the combining of hives so that all of a sudden you may have a beekeeper who owns 22,000 hives that are scattered over 5 different states. They don't have the resources to take care, to feed them when they're not in a pollination service. So they are looking for other areas to place those bees for them to have that access to food and forage. So that's where it comes in to bring them back out to the ag areas. Because that, you know, in discussion with some of the beekeepers, I asked them, I said, well, if you moved your bees up in some wildlife area or some forest area, you're getting away from the ag sector.
Farther away from pesticides.
Do you have better survival? And they said, well, yeah, but we don't have the honey production then. Because in a fertilized, irrigated crop area, you're going to have higher yield and honey.
What don't we know? What are the key points to unraveling this thing?
I think what we do, and I'll touch on both things here that both Don and Lori had mentioned, though. What we do know is that bee decline is a nationally recognized problem, and it demands attention from the scientific community, but it also demands attention from both the apiculture and the agricultural industries. And the key is to get all parties working together. We know there are multiple stressors, and how to manage those stressors, I think, is one of the biggest challenges. And so as a scientist, I'm always interested in working with apiculturists and agriculturists and identifying, you know, what are their needs, and am I meeting those needs for research areas? Rather than just doing individual science that benefits me, I want to take it back to them.
One more, and then I'd like to open it up again to questions from the floor. And Lori, maybe you want to go first with this, but all of you, really. You mentioned the product that Bayer Crop Science came out with. What is the role of agribusiness? You also mentioned the conflict, which is why you needed to bring all these players to the table. So there's a little bit of a catch-22, certainly in public perception here, but what is the role of and what is required of the agricultural business and industry?
Well, let me preface this by saying I think we're really... we were robbed of a great opportunity by not having Zach Browning here today, because I think having a beekeeper speak for himself is the same as having a farmer speak for him or herself. And those are voices that everybody needs to listen to, and Zach Browning is one that I think is one of the best. He's a good beekeeper. And when I listen to the farmers here describe how difficult it is to raise a crop, I know that's true. And it's very difficult to be a beekeeper. It's hard work, and it's discouraging when you see these huge losses. When you open a hive and you're devastated by your livestock disappearing, a third of your livestock is gone. And that's typical. It could be 70%. So we're depauperate today a bit because we don't have his voice. But the role of the pesticide industry, and remember, it's crop protection when they're talking about themselves, and it's poison when other people are talking about them. So we've got to meet in the middle. We've got to look at balance. I loved what Chad said prior to this when he said, should I go for a home run or is a double okay? In the environment, we tend to characterize things as it's got to be this way or it's got to be this way. And in fact, in the reality of the world, we have to have the environment and the economy working together, or we're not going to make it. We have to have those two hand in hand in order to solve these big problems.
Troy, from your perspective?
I completely agree with what Lori has said, is that, you know, I wish Zach was here, because, you know, part of our, you know, motivation for doing the study in Virginia is that, you know, beekeepers in Virginia are losing 30% of their colonies on an annual basis. They're losing close to $2 million a year in colony replacement costs. And that's, you know, it's a major problem for them in their livelihood, and, you know, and not to be able to, you know, provide them with some sort of, you know, remedy for those stressor challenges that they're having. It's frustrating to me. And so I really want to work with them. And I agree that we know between, you know, agriculture and apiculture, there needs to be kind of a middle road here. I think, you know, it tends to be an all or nothing approach with this. And I don't think we can do that anymore. And to get both parties on board to be able to manage some of these challenges.
Quick comment on, then I want to go to the audience for questions.
I volunteered to take Zach's badge and represent him, but they wouldn't let me.
Nah.
Yeah, he is a great guy, and I've worked quite a bit with Zach and some of the others. I think that one of the, you know, right now there are some efforts. For instance, North Dakota has already brought in all of the different stakeholders to sit down at the table and talk about, okay, from a pesticide issue, how can we cooperate? How can we improve communication? What's the responsibility? And this is an important thing to keep in mind. What's the responsibility of the producer, and what's the responsibility of the beekeeper? Because as we had a discussion one time, I told him, I said, you know, your group is the ones that ask to be there. You choose to put your bees on that property. So you have a responsibility there as well. So it's what's the responsibility of both groups to come together and find a way to coexist. There has been a large effort in North Dakota. There's one underway now in Florida, where the Department of Ag brought in all the different stakeholders to sit down and discuss it. Mississippi has just completed one themselves, and they brought in the aerial applicators, the consultants, the producers, the Mississippi Farm Bureau, the Extension Service, the Bureau of Plant Industries. Everybody sat down. They came up with a plan of how can we all cooperate together. They even came up with a flag that looks like beef stripes, so that everybody would recognize that flag to be a marker that bees are present in that area, be aware, be cautious of activities in this area. So there's some great efforts.
But what are they supposed to do? I mean, so fine, so the flag is there. Are they supposed to, are there particular pesticides they've been told to use, to not use at all, or to use less of, or to use in different ways, or other activities that they're supposed to change or curb?
It's more of just being very conscious whenever you're around that, that you follow the label, that everything is, you follow the label. If you can spray later in the afternoon, the later the better, because the bees, you know, at nighttime, the bees will go back in their hive. So if you're late afternoon, they've got some work right now in Mississippi that has shown later in the day they have less activity of the bees in the field. So there would be all of those things working together. From the pesticide standpoint, I think, though, that what is critical for us to keep in mind is that still where all the focus and the discussions are going on, and this Varroa summit is huge, because Varroa came in, what, in the 80s?
In the 80s, late 80s, yeah.
And Varroa has spread across many other continents and has been a tremendous parasite of bees, and it's spreading viruses itself.
Laura, you and I were talking, and you have this great word picture that you do with this, that you got to do.
With the Varroa mite, it would be very similar to, in this room, each of us having a rabbit on our back. That's about the scale of this. And we would have rabbits hopping all around, and we would have rabbits sucking our children's bodies and killing them. And then they would also be infecting us with disease. So this is the climate that's inside the hive right now. It's ubiquitous. It's in virtually every hive in the United States, this activity. It started in the late 80s. It came in on a queen that was imported from another country. It made the bees crazy. They vacated the hives, much as colony collapse disorder. They could not stand. They couldn't tolerate this invasion. But I wanted to answer Frank's question more directly about the responsibility of the pesticide industry. When you develop a product, you have a responsibility to make sure that it is used in the correct way. You have the obligation to help the people that you are serving do the right thing. And that kind of training is much more credible when it comes from the chemical industry than if it comes from a conservation group. It means it's coming from someone who wants the farmer to succeed, but also wants the farmer to do well by his stewardship. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity to help with things like night spraying and with drift and with making sure that that label is adhered to, because that is a problem when people take a good product and use it without much thought.
You know, that's a really great point. It actually brings it makes me think a little bit of the conversation we had yesterday on water.
Yes.
And the need for these partnerships to have information, whether it's from conservation groups, from associations, agricultural associations, from science, from industry. Questions from the floor before we move on to our next panel. Yes, ma'am.
Has the data that any of you all have seen that reflects real field situations shown that neonicotinoids can harm or kill honeybees or bees or pollinators in any way?
You don't actually have to look at field studies. You can read the label. The label tells you these will kill honeybees, pollinators, pesticides. Do that. That's what they're designed to do.
But see, that's where we run into these problems of people talking about, well, this product says it's toxic. Well, yeah, it's toxic, but there's more to it. Whenever you start talking about it, the risk is a factor of how toxic is it and what is the exposure component. And so it may be toxic to bees, but if you are using it at a time when bees are not present, it's not killing anything. And so that's where we run into some of the challenges here, is the use of the product to get it through EPA, which is a very rigorous process. There are mitigation efforts that EPA goes through to say, well, it's toxic, but is your use actually going to reduce exposure to where that you are not going to be jeopardizing some of these other organisms that are out there. So to answer your question, the research that came out of that Mid-South group at this point shows that there was not a toxicity of the use of those neonicotinoid seed treatments in cotton.
Right on the aisle here. Thank you.
Thanks for the information you provided. This message is for question is for Lori. Lori, for corn and soybean farmers who are, you know, growing crops from fence row these days and aren't looking at providing or aren't thinking about providing habitat for honeybees because of the dollars and cents that is in their mind, what's your message to those guys?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. What's the economic incentive for me to put in a buffer strip, for me to put in cover crops? We did a survey of the farmers of Montana, and we had 125 farmers respond, and we asked them, have you put in pollinator plantings? And these were the 125 who said yes. We said, have you actually seen any pollinators come? They said, no, we've seen some for our family truck gardens and so forth, but what we've seen is less invasive species. We have seen less soil erosion.
Soil erosion?
Yes, because these are native plants that are going to hold the soil. So they're providing forage, but they're getting something for the landscape. So if you're not using a pollinator-dependent, if you're not growing a pollinator-dependent crop, what's in it for you? A lot is in it for you. We're also looking at CRP landscapes. We're doing an assessment for FSA of how these pollinator landscapes are affecting regional landscapes. This is something that one of the pesticide companies, BASF, studied in England. They looked at using just 3% of the landscape for these pollinator areas, and the health of the landscape overall improved dramatically. So I know there's a sense in the farming community that maybe we should just get rid of these things. Why do we even want them around? If we spray incorrectly, we're going to get in trouble. There is a way to coexist and to get real benefits for the farmer, even if it's not for your specific crop. It helps your landscape. Yeah. I hope that answers it.
And you know, that's a point that, Project Apiseum out in California, and they have a website too, but Project Apiseum is doing some work out there looking at planting forage habitats because of the almond industry having so many bees and pollinators out there. They're trying to plant habitats that are native and good in California. And we've talked to ARS about helping us identify across the country what plants would work in different regions, because I believe that's an area that soybeans, corn, cotton, and beekeepers could all come together and say, hey, here's some areas we can really move forward pretty quick, working on some CRP land, some different types of conservation practices to put some pollinator habitats in.
What, could I answer one more thing? There is another iconic problem that we haven't discussed, which is the monarch butterfly. And the monarch goes through the Great Plains. There are three migratory routes. We have a lot of information about this on our website. Does the monarch butterfly help pollination of crops? Probably not. Is the monarch butterfly one of the great treasures of our world? Yes. Do farmers want to be the ones who say, well, you know, we didn't leave enough milkweed, we didn't leave enough edges that could support this migratory corridor? I don't think so. I think this is emblematic. I think it's iconic. It's something we want to preserve, and we don't want it to go away on our watch. And I believe farmers want to participate in that. So I think farmers really have a role to play in this, especially in the Midwest, in the Plains states.
Another question from the floor. I mean, once, twice, thrice? Nope. Last question that I'd address to all of you before moving on then is, as you think about the research that's underway, the activity that's taking place both in industry and in science, and the real, very, very serious crisis that is on us with respect to the loss of these pollinators, what should we be looking for realistically to come out of the research and some of these other activities in the next couple of years? What's in the pipeline in terms of the research, in terms of the products, in terms of what we know to advance this discussion?
I think we will get a better understanding of how these pollinators are interacting with the crops and how, you know, what are they carrying back to the hive and how does that impact the hive? It's not just the forager that's going out, but it's what it carries back to the hive and how that impacts it.
Troy,
I think
done.
A big thing with... Sure. That is going to be probably the major thing is the results out of this Varroa summit, because there is so little that we know about this insect this mite that is a major parasite across multiple countries.
Get this bunny off my back.
That's right. Yeah, so I think, you know, to agree with Don here is that, you know, there are a lot of intriguing studies, laboratory studies that show proof of concept of pesticide residue exposures causing health effects with bees, but that doesn't necessarily translate to things back in the colony. And that's one of the unique things that we're doing at Virginia Tech, is that we're assessing pesticide risk at the colony level. You cannot take these insects out of that colony, put them in a laboratory for a week to run these pesticide assays, because you're taking out the complete influence of its surroundings. And so we do need more semi and full field trials of these, or assessments, I should say, of these pesticides. The Varroa mite is a major pest challenge for the apiculture industry that we really need to find a solution to. It's probably one of the primary causes for periodical losses of bee decline in the country, and we need new strategies to be able to manage that pest.
Briefly, the look ahead?
The look ahead, I don't think research is going to give us a silver bullet. I think like most really complex problems, it's going to take a lot of action to make it solved, just like human health issues. But what is thrilling is that this has risen to the level, the tipping point, where it's on everybody's radar, and it's because everybody's got skin in this game. We all eat, and the people who have, who touch the landscape from classrooms to golf courses to homes to window boxes to farms to ranches, we all have a stake in this, and there's all some, we can all do something.
Okay. I want to thank you all very much for the insight on this one, and obviously this is the mystery continues and the research continues. This is not going to be either a silver bullet or an overnight solution. Thanks. Thanks very
much.
Thank you.
So up next, and before we go into a break and continue on, oops, losing my microphone there. That's not good.